These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
It's getting colder outside, and coming up, many kids and adults alike will enjoy getting dressed up for Halloween. So with a nod to trick-or-treating, today we're talking about pretending on the show. Also this hour, we'll learn about play therapy methods for children and hear a new installment of our Dr. KTD feature about imaginary friends. That and more this hour on Kids These Days. How are you and the little ones going to celebrate Halloween 2011? Or do you sit this particular event out? Well, we want to know, so please tell us. Write to us at mail@kidsthesedays.org and let us know your plans. That or comment on our website or our Facebook page. I know I hear it a lot, that play is a child's work. So how important is playing and pretending when it comes to the normal development of children? And does it change over the course of their development? Well, with me to talk about this subject today are two Alaskans who know a lot about the subject. Robert Capuso is an associate professor of early childhood development at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He's also a parent educator with Providence Alaska Medical Center, where he primarily works with new and expecting fathers and their babies. At UAA, one of the courses Robert teaches is Creativity and the Arts in Early Childhood. The primary outcomes of the course are that adult students rediscover the creativity they possessed as a child, that they come to realize that they are creative in one way or another, and that creativity happens in everyday life. Robert lives in Anchorage with his wonderful wife and their two children. Thanks, Robert, for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Shona Strasser joins us by phone this hour. Shona is the education director at Perseverance Theater in Juneau. Shona used to work at the Seattle Repertory Theater and came up to direct a play in the STAR program. That's the Summer Theater Arts Rendezvous at Perseverance. And throughout her career, she's worked with at-risk youth in the lower 48 to use theater as a tool to make healthy choices. Today she's in Los Angeles, and that's where she joins us from. Thanks to you, Shona, for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, the show is about the importance of pretending, of playing, of imagining. It seems appropriate to start with the youngest of kids. So, Robert, maybe you can explain what may seem obvious and maybe isn't so obvious. Why is it that play is something that kids do and is possibly important that they do?
Well, first off, play is extremely important in the healthy development of young children. And you mentioned something that play is sort of almost frivolous activity that children engage in. But in actuality, it isn't. It's very important, and not only do children do this, but all mammals do this in their healthy development. Some research that I have here that I could share at some point states that when kids don't have those opportunities to play when they're younger, they turn out to be unhealthy adults in one way or the other. And maybe Shona will explain, maybe that's the population she's working with when, you know, kids grow up.
Right. Shona, that's a great question for you. In some of the work that you've done before you were at Perseverance, maybe at Perseverance, have you seen what could be an outcome of a young kid who didn't get an opportunity to play when they were younger?
Well, I think most of it stems from kids having to grow up too fast. Maybe that they, in not all cases, but in some single parent families in which a large portion of the weight of a household falls on the young person. And so that kind of as they grow older, there's a little rebellion there because they haven't had an opportunity to have those healthy, you know, play times that that they kind of make some different choices. So they can play a little bit later, but they're playing in ways that we don't necessarily want them to play.
Right. I want to go back to something that you said, Robert. You said that we are mammals, obviously humans are mammals, and that this is something that humans do. Play mm-hmm. is a part of normal development, and that play is something that other mammals do. I'm kind of curious about that. I don't know anything about how, you know, regular other mammals might play as children or juveniles?
Well, I'm by no means an expert on this topic, but what I could say is that play for children and mammals is a way that they learn about their life and practice for future encounters in their life. So we see with even 1 to 2 year olds, young toddlers are pretend playing what they see in their life, changing a baby's diaper or cooking dinner in a dramatic play area. These skills will help them as they become older children and adults.
So for like, I guess I'm just trying to imagine, like you see video, I haven't seen this in real life, of wolf pups who are jumping all over each other and they're kind of playing at being rough and maybe establishing where they're going to be in a hierarchy. Is that what you're talking about? How other mammals play in healthy development or
that's development? Exactly what I'm talking about. And we even see that with young children with the sort of rough and tumble play, which oftentimes in school settings or preschool setting is sort of outlawed for fear that children will get hurt or injured in some way. But that's, I believe, an outcome of our sort of history as humans, that this was more a part of our lives in the past.
Rough and tumble kind of play.
Rough and tumble kind of play, which is still super important because it helps kids gain a sense of body awareness. It helps them learn to read the emotions of others. Rough and tumble play is not play fighting. Children are actively engaging in this sort of rough and tumble play. They're taking turns at who's going to be on top, who's going to be more submissive, and it's much different than play fighting, because you'll see that children constantly are coming back to this sort of play situation.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to little kids, now that we're back to humans, when it comes to little kids and what you're talking about with normal development, Robert Capuzzo, I'll ask you again. I'm wondering if you can help the layperson. I know you have a lot of background in this. So help the layperson understand like how, you know, a child who's 2 may play differently than a child who's 4, pretend differently than a child who's 4 and a child who's 6 and so forth. So can you kind of explain what normal type of playing and pretending would look like with children as they go from being really young into, say, like their early elementary years?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. When children are really young, say between 1 and 2 years old, they're already starting to play. They're reenacting scenes that they see in their everyday lives. So it's actual things that mom and dad do around the house that they're reenacting, which helps them understand what's happening in that life. As children get older, these play scenarios get much more complex. They're able to use their imaginations a lot more to take on different roles in their play. So instead of being a mom, they may be an aunt from, you know, Indiana or something, and totally give her a new set of characteristics in this play scenario. Further, what really happens as kids get older is they start interacting more with one another. Those young 1 and 2 year olds are playing by themselves oftentimes. They're not really cooperatively playing with one another. As kids get older, they're interacting, so these situations get much more complex and unique to those situations. And that's where you really, it's actually amazing when you sit down and you see 4 or 5 year olds in this play scene, and you're just wondering, how the heck do they come up with this stuff? And it's interesting because we, at one point, had those abilities too. And something happens as we get older, whether it's our brains are pruning or we just forget how creative we once were. We don't have opportunities to practice our creativity. Or at some point through our schooling, we just were told that we weren't creative, or we got the message that it's not important to us. So as kids get older, they start interacting more with one another in their play scenarios, and these become much richer experiences.
Shona Strasser, the work that you do, working with kids and adults alike in a theater setting, what Robert Capuzzo was just talking about, where, you know, a child who's 5 and 6 and in a group, they may come up with these really outlandish, amazing scenarios, and then somehow that is something that maybe is lost as people age. How do you work with that and maybe even around that in the work that you do?
Well, the first thing that we always have to do in theater is create, you know, an environment that is comfortable for play. And so that means that you know that nobody there is going to actually say, you know, it's not okay to play right here. It's always okay to play. Like, it's actually your job to play. So, which I find I'm very lucky that it is my job to actually use my imagination and play. And so with kids, it's that also I love school. I'm not bashing school in any form or fashion. But when you sit down in a desk and you're asked to sit down every day from 8 to 3 or 8 to 4, however the case may be, and with little times to play, there's definitely music, and I so appreciate all the PE that happens. But when you're asked to sit down over and over and over again, a lot of creativity happens actually when you're moving. And so that's something that we have to relearn. And I think that's something maybe, Robert, that with the young kids, they're constantly moving because they're exploring how to move. And then when they get into, you know, kindergarten and first grade, they're asked to sit down. So what we have to do right away is get them up on their feet again.
Robert Capuzzo, I like what we just heard Shona say. She's talking about how sometimes, in her experience, creativity is so linked to moving, and little kids are so hard to stop them from moving. And then at some point in a school setting, sometimes they're transitioning from moving into being more stationary in their learning. You know, you have a lot of knowledge about different methods for teaching children, and there are methods that incorporate this idea of play into learning. Can you maybe explain how, you know, that might relate to this idea of creativity being linked to moving?
Oh, I'd love to. So we know that young children, and when I say young children, I mean up to third grade is usually birth through eight is what we consider young children. Young children shouldn't be sitting down for extended periods of time. So in many schools, you'll see that kindergarten, first, second, third graders are up moving around the classroom. They should not be sitting in their desks for long periods of time. And I would say for all learners, even adults, it's very difficult to sit down for extended periods of time. So having sort of brain breaks or exercise gym or something where you're getting up and moving and refreshing yourself is very important for all learners of all ages. I think Shona is right that something happens when children are forced to sit in their desks all day. And I think it's coupled by the fact that not only are they sitting in their desks, but what they're expected to do or not do when they're in their desks is the real issue in my mind. That the lessons that they're given are not allowing children to really be creative at all. It's sort of a teacher-directed curriculum. And it's not the case for all schools or all preschool programs. But many of them we see are moving towards a more teacher-directed, standards-based, scripted type curriculum where children really don't have any say in what's happening in the classroom. So it may be that what the curriculum says you're supposed to be teaching in the month of October, the children have no interest whatsoever in what that curriculum is telling them to learn. Conversely, what should and what I preach to my students is that you have to really get to know your learners, see what they're interested in, see what their likes and dislikes are, and then gear that towards the standards of Alaska. There's a million ways that we could meet those standards. So you can have kids learning about walruses or volcanoes and meet those same math standards that that packaged curriculum is telling you to do.
Now, I'm not a teacher, but I'm just imagining the challenge of standing in front of a whole classroom, a full classroom of fourth graders, and saying, you guys don't have enough input in what we're doing today. You know, let's have you tell me what we're going to be doing. I mean, how do you actually do that?
Yes, and that's the thing. A play-based sort of emergent curriculum that I'm describing here is a lot more difficult for a teacher to manage than let's follow what a curriculum tells me to do. It requires that teacher is constantly interacting with his or her class, assessing where their needs are, and then going back nightly or weekly to sort of decide where this curriculum is going. So it's a lot more intensive. But I think, and when I see this happening, I know it's true, that kids are going to be a lot more engaged in those classrooms. And I think even the educator in that classroom, while it might be more work, it's more meaningful to her because she or he has some control over what's happening in the class. Some teachers they're being told what to do throughout the whole day. And maybe for some, that's okay. They don't mind that. But to me, I often ask myself, why do students, pre-service teachers, go to school for 4+ years, then they get into a classroom and they're being told what to do? I think these individual teachers have a lot to say about what should be going into those lessons.
And Shona Strausser, I imagine you said that you get paid to play. So I imagine that you are that person sometimes standing in front of a group of young people and telling them to give you cues on how that hour or that day is going to go. Is that the case?
I'm always that person. Mm-hmm. Yes. And you know, it's for classroom teachers, it does become overwhelming because it's also about creating different curriculum for each group of students you're with. So if you see, you know, especially if you're in middle school and you see 4 different groups a day, you're having to be present in the room and responding to those needs of those students right then, as opposed to doing the same curriculum for every single class. So it does become, like Robert said, it just becomes harder. It's more time-consuming, for sure. But it is, the rewards are so great because you can see, you know, those kids have those light bulb moments exactly when you're having them. So that's a really nice kind of place to be. So being kind of in front of the group there and responding to the needs, you know, most of the stuff that I do is always physical first. And then once the physical is developed, then we start adding the voice. And it's amazing how much more comfortable students will be with their voice once their bodies have been fully charged. Because I can be in a classroom and, you know, watching. I do observation of classrooms, too. So I'll be watching a student, and it usually has to do with, you know, boys who want to be super active all the time, that... You know, the things that come out of their mouths, they blurt things out and they get in trouble for that. But if you kind of reverse that, flip it, make it so that the lesson is really active and the movement is, you know, constant, that impulse to kind of push out and just say whatever comes off the top of the head is less because you're, you know, expressing emotion through your body or other ways.
Interesting. Well, this is Kids These Days, and today we're talking about pretending on the show. And with me to do that are Shona Strausser, who directs education programs at Juno's Perseverance Theater, and Robert Capuzzo, who's an associate professor of early childhood development at UAA. And as I mentioned, we're talking about how pretending and playing are important parts of a child's development. So perhaps it makes sense that kids whose lives haven't been so normal may benefit from some extra doses of a very specific kind of play therapy. Our regular contributor, Jessica Cochran, set out to learn what play therapy is and how it's being used to help kids.
Little Tykes Therapeutic Services serves children ages 2 to 5 in a setting that looks a lot like a daycare. But it's not. It's actually group therapy.
It went straight down.
Little Tykes is a program of Anchorage Community Mental Health. Instead of teachers, there are clinicians who are trained to use play therapy techniques to work with severely emotionally disturbed children. Today, they are practicing their techniques on volunteers so they don't violate the privacy of their client families. One technique is child-directed play.
You're so happy that happened. Now you're trying to figure out how to connect these two things together.
As clinical director Jamie Carlbaum puts it, the kids are in charge. If kids start to get physically rough with a toy, instead of stepping in immediately to stop the behavior, the clinician will watch to see what they're acting out. If the child wants the staff person to play an invisible dragon, that's what the staff person will do. It's empowering for the kids.
What we do is validate. So if a child is building blocks, we would say, oh, you put the red block on the blue block. Or I like the way you put the blue block on the red block. You're kind of validating what they're doing. Or if a child says, what is this for? You would restate what their question is and say, you're wondering what this is for. And you're just validating them so they start having... The emotions change to, I've been abused, I'm not worthy, towards, wow, somebody's listening to me, I'm being heard, I am important, I am worthy. And so it's just a method of helping their brain get reprogrammed.
Holter, that's a nice smile, good job.
All right. Now we have a new.
At other times during the day, clinicians like Chelsea Dunham and Elaine Hutchinson direct things. During group circle time, they may work on identifying and expressing emotions.
What you just got. How do we feel when we get presents?
Happy.
We're happy, and if we didn't expect it, we're.
Dunham says they use a curriculum that was originally developed to use with children exposed to domestic violence, but seems to be working with all of their kids.
During circle time, we engage the kids using a curriculum called Second Step, which is evidence-based. It's been used for years and years, and it's shown to be very effective in violence prevention. So that helps the kids learn how to identify their feelings, how to identify triggers for their feelings, and also how to problem solve when they're having conflicts, and how to use coping skills.
Surprise! Surprise! Wow! We didn't expect it!
Hi.
Look! Puppy's showing us what we do when we're surprised! Oh my gosh! Oh my gosh!
Pretending is a big part of play therapy. During child-directed playtime, kids often reenact scenes as a way of processing or just communicating what they've experienced. During directed therapy, staff might ask the kids to pretend.
We use pretending. We might pretend that we're angry, and we might pretend how we are going to help each other out, or we might pretend using our coping skills. So we definitely use pretending there.
Over time, putting words to those emotions and practicing them gives kids the tools to deal with their surroundings.
One child came in and he had been in multiple foster care placements, and this is actually a pretty average story for a lot of our kids. In multiple foster care placements and reunited with his family, and had tough times transitioning between activities. So, you know, going from playtime to snack time, he would pretty much have a panic attack and start screaming and crying, and it would take a very long time for him to calm down. He was oppositional and didn't want to follow directions and didn't want to engage with his friends, you know, his peers in play. So he's very withdrawn and isolated and moody and anxious all the time. And since being with us, and it's been about, oh, I'd say six to 8 months, he's able to transition now very easily between activities. He stays calm, and he's starting to be able to tell us when he's feeling angry or sad or worried or scared. And that's amazing, because before he wouldn't at all tell us what was going on and would only act out. And so now he's able to talk to us about it. He's able to tell us what's making him feel worried. He's able to transition between activities. And he's now starting to play with his peers. And that's very exciting for us, because the more he interacts with other kids, the less lonely and isolated he'll feel. And so that's very exciting to see him sharing, taking turns, and even dealing with conflicts with peers.
Play therapy isn't just for young kids. It can be hard for anyone to express themselves verbally about a tough topic. Roseanne Lynch is a certified play therapist in Ketchikan. She's president of the Alaska chapter of the Association for Play Therapy. She asks her teenage clients to use materials to decorate the inside and outside of masks.
They use these things as metaphors. So instead of saying, I'm not sure about my boyfriend, I think he's cheating on me and I feel scared and hurt, they can use an item to depict that. So they can let me know what's going on in their lives without having to actually say things in depth.
Even adults, they might create scenes with a sand table and end up revealing lots of issues too hard to talk about directly. Lynch uses lots of play therapy techniques during family therapy. She says having the right training is essential.
Some topics are just too sensitive, and to do it in a play theme is safer. The information is still coming out because I'm trained, so I know what I'm looking for, and it's not just I have an activity for this family to do. It's really a therapeutic activity for the family to take from it, you know, the pieces that are important to them.
Training to become a certified play therapist is intense. In addition to the regular requirements for therapists, they need 150 hours of instruction in play therapy, 500 hours of experience, and 50 hours of supervision experience. The Alaska chapter of the Association for Play Therapy offers a training conference each year for those interested in learning more about it. I'm Jessica Cochran.
And I'm Shanna Sheehy, and this is Kids These Days. Shona Strausser, I know that you are not a play therapist, but you do work with kids, and you play with them in the theater, and they pretend, and I thought you might be the perfect person to ask for a reaction to the story that we just heard.
Yeah, well, a lot of this play therapy actually stems from work in theater, which is really kind of interesting. It's pretty new. I mean, I say new in the last 30 years. new kind of ways to come about therapy. And a lot of it is based on a man's work named Augusta Boal, and he does Theater of the Oppressed. And it was actually ways to get people in Civil War-torn countries to be able to communicate with each other and address issues that were happening in the moment. And it's something called playback theater. And so this theater technique has been actually adapted in many ways to come into this play therapy, which is wonderful and exactly what I'm doing in the classroom with high-risk students. I also go into places where adolescents are behind bars, so to speak, and work with students there. And that's exactly what it is. It's play therapy.
You know, earlier in the program you mentioned observing these light bulb moments with students. I'm wondering, have you had that experience with some at-risk kids? Any that you could possibly share?
Yeah, well, so a lot of this playback therapy, kind of the starting of the scenes, so I'll have students, high school students especially, go through, so we'll talk about, so how did you end up here, you know, and that's usually for kids who are incarcerated. And they'll talk to me about, you know, what they did. And I said, well, what was the specific moment? And we'll go to that specific moment. And we'll stage that specific moment. We'll also stage the moment before. And then we'll also stage the moment after. You know, exactly what happened, the cops came, or, you know, or where there was some abuse or something like that. And so you'll take them through the scene. And right before, there was a choice made, and whether that's a positive choice or a bad choice. In most of these cases, it's a choice that it was not a great choice. You'll take it up to that point, and you'll stop the scene. You know, we'll stop the scene. And then we actually stage options. We stage even a worse option. We stage a better option. We stage, so they've seen all these options. And a lot of times we'll cast another student as them. So let's say it's one I can think of recently is a boy who stole a car. And so we put a girl into the stealing car scene, and we took it right to the point where she was about to steal the car, and the boy, you know, he just stopped right there. He put his head in his hands, and he knew at that. I mean, he knew it was a bad choice already because of where he was. But then we talked about what the other options were and staged those, and he just didn't realize he had other options. You know, so that was a, you know, major aha moment for him. He was like, oh, wow, I could have. Nobody had talked to him about the other options before.
Wow. Well, you're tuned into Kids These Days. Kids These Days is made possible through a number of important partnerships. We're an independently produced program of the Content Producers Guild, and we record this program at the studios of KSKA-FM in Anchorage, Alaska. The Alaska Public Radio Network helps with distribution of our show. Major funding comes from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Find out more about us and where we come from by checking out our About Us portion of our website. That's kidsthesedays.org. Each week, Kids These Days tackles a new topic that's important to all Alaskans, whether you're actively raising children or not. Today, in observance of Halloween, we're discussing playing, pretending, and imagining. How do these things help us turn into fully developed people? I'll be back in the second half of the show to talk more about that with guests Robert Capuzzo of UAA and Shona Strausser of Perseverance Theater. Also still to come, we find out what people remember about pretending in a new installment of our When I Was Young feature. And we get the opinion of our very own Dr. KTD about imaginary friends. Did you have one? Tell us about it while we take this break. We'll be back in just a minute.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three. Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation. What we'll see will defy explanation. If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it. Want to change the world? There's nothing to it.
Next time on Kids These Days, we take a good look at an important and often enduring family relationship, siblings. Guest host Kathleen McCoy talks with experts about how siblings relate to each other and change throughout the lifespan. Also this hour, we hear personal reflections on adult siblings who have come back together later in life, and we learn about a support group for brothers and sisters of kids who have cancer. Join us for that and more next time on Kids These Days. We're back. This is Kids These Days, and I'm Shanna Sheehy. I'm talking today with Shona Strausser, who's on the phone from Los Angeles. Shona is the education director at Perseverance Theater in Juneau. And in the studio with me is Robert Capuzzo, an early childhood development associate professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage. If you have something to say about this topic, we invite you to do so. Email us, send messages to mail@kidsthesedays.org, or you can comment directly on our website or our Facebook page. Well, in this beginning of the second half of the show, Robert, maybe you could explain a little more around some of the themes I felt like I found as I was looking into the benefits of creative play and pretending, in particular when it comes to little kids. So the things that I kept running into as I was reading were that playing and pretending helps children develop language skills and communication skills, social emotional skills, and then also thinking skills. And I imagine you can explain how that happens and maybe even round that list out a little bit for us.
Oh, yes. So when kids are engaged in pretend play and play in general, it's often filled with language. And this is language that you wouldn't find if a teacher were directing the classroom and asking the kids questions. When kids are pretending in a scenario with one another, the language is happening at that moment. So that ability for that child to react to what their playmate said and come back with a response is a skill and is an opportunity that you can't get in many other situations. That alone is one of the major reasons that children should be encouraged, facilitated to engage in this pretend play or dramatic play. The social-emotional benefits are numerous and well-documented in the research. When kids are playing and engaged in pretend play, they really are working on their social skills and their emotional skills. So their social skills alone, they need to be taking turns when they're doing this pretend play. Emotionally, maybe I want to have the little doll, and my friend actually wants the doll. So we need to sort that out emotionally, that you can have a turn now, and then I'll have a turn next. The cognitive skills are well documented as well. In these play situations, they're using numerous cognitive abilities as they sort through a play situation and reenact something that they might have seen or that they're creating.
Okay, then I'm going to ask you about something else that I found repeating in some of the articles that I was reading. I found, for example, CNN, on CNN.com, we found an article that said that colleges, like high-end colleges that are recruiting students, they're finding that that students who have engaged in creative play more as children have a better theory of mind, and that makes them better students as they move on to their university experience. Can you explain what this theory of mind is and how that might play out through a child's development all the way into early adulthood?
Well, yes, I've run into this too, this idea of theory of mind when children have these opportunities to play. And my understanding is that when children are engaged in this pretend play, working through situations with one another, they really begin to understand other people's feelings. And there's really no other situations that kids could get placed in where they have these opportunities to understand how we communicate with one another. And this is a mild buzz these days, is that it's really important to focus on children's social and emotional development. And with standards-based education and testing and accountability, oftentimes children's social and emotional development is sort of, you know, not really focused on as much. But it's huge. And I have a quote here from an educational psychologist, Anthony Pellegrini. He says, "You don't become socially competent by teachers telling you how to behave. You learn those skills by interacting with your peers, learning what's acceptable, what's not acceptable." So in social play, children use and develop things like persistence and communication skills and negotiation skills and accommodating others in their play, where if we don't allow this to happen in the early grades and in early childhood, I think what we're going to find is that as they get into high school or young adulthood, that there are going to be more interpersonal problems that we really already see in today's world, conflicts with one another.
And Shona Strasser, in your work with, you work with youth and you also work with adults in an education setting in theater, and you've been doing this for some time. I don't know if this is possible for you to answer, but have you seen any changes over the course of the work that you've done in terms of how capable kids are when it comes to knowing how to play?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's an interesting thing, because that's actually when, I mean, in my line of work, that's actually when you become a professional theater person. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Is that when you've actually developed the tools enough to play. And it does take a long time. I mean, because like Robert's saying, it's like you have to structure play. I mean, it's not, it's about, you know, it takes discipline to play also. Because it does need to be safe, and it does need to be, mainly safe. So that's exactly it. If you just kind of watch students become better players, and what that means is that they're thinking less in terms of what's going to be the wrong thing to say. They're thinking more in terms of, what is something I can say here that will add? It's a yes and theory. I say yes to you, and what can we add to this? And I play that a lot with kids, especially young ones, because it says, you know, it helps people understand each other. You know, we're going to, everybody let's jump up and down. Yes, let's. And everybody fall down on the ground and, do Angel in the Snow. Yes, let's. So it kind of helps people just play more and understand good, healthy ways of playing.
Is there some sort of take-home message in this for parents? Like, should parents be thinking very critically about how it is that their children are playing in their homes, and it should have more structure or it should have less structure? I'm hearing maybe support of both of those ideas from what you guys are saying. I'm just wondering if there's a take-home message for parents.
I think it's just allowing the time, really. Making sure that there's time to play, and that, because what I find mostly in students who are high-risk, at-risk students, they haven't had the time to play, and also they haven't been listened to about what they want to talk about, you know, and play with.
Mm-hmm. And Robert Capuzzo?
Yes, I think there's some take-home messages for parents. And the first one is, and I know Shona had mentioned this, is that we see kids are being rushed through childhood at way too fast of a rate. And this is a time in our lives when it should really be cherished, and we should save this experience for kids, because far too soon they're going to be young adults and be done with this time period. So let your kids be kids is really the message that I have to them. Really value that when they're engaged in this unstructured sort of free play, that it's actually one of the most beneficial things that your kids could be doing. What happens is that many parents think they're doing the best thing for their kids by signing them up for piano and gymnastics and after-school tutoring. But what kids really need is this unstructured time where they could make their own play, where they could sort of take the initiative and make their own games, make their own fun, make their own rules. When they're constantly being told what to do and what to study and how to do this in gymnastics, they're losing that ability to be creative and really use their imagination. And I think that's what I see when I have students come into my college class, is that they haven't had the opportunities to really take any initiative. So we're sort of, like Shona's doing with her students, it's like you have to relearn that and feel what it was like to be a kid again. Mm-hmm. And then, like you're saying, it's sort of a little bit of this and a little bit of that. A lot of times, parents feel like they need to be constantly peppering their kids when they're playing in the family room, asking them questions. What are you doing? Well, what about this? What about that? Oftentimes, that's distracting to the child. We need to let them do their own thing. If they want to ask us questions or need something, they can ask us. You could offer something here and there, but sometimes just let your child do what he or she wants to do. Sometimes, though, parents take that to the extreme and they never get involved with their kids' play. So sometimes it's very important to get into their play. And like they're doing at Little Tykes, let your child lead you in the play. Be naive. Pretend like you don't know what you're doing and have them tell you how to be Goldilocks or how to be the bunny in the story. That's exactly,
Robert, I agree. Kind of what I mean by structure in play is that they are guiding you, but that, that you're listening to their voice, and that actually creates structure. You know, they will create the structure for you, essentially.
Right.
There are a couple other things that I'd like to add, because I think it's really important for parents to realize that children can play with things around their house or around the yard that are going to be extremely educational and that don't cost any money. So there are these open-ended materials that we have lying over all of our houses. Empty little butter containers or pine cones or empty boxes that children will take these items and create the world with. But if you buy your child a certain toy, oftentimes that toy is just meant to be one use. So open-ended materials can be used for many things and allow kids to really be creative. Another thing that I really have to put in here is that it's super important that kids and families get outside and use the outdoors, wintertime and summertime here in Alaska. There's so much that children can do when they're outside, and they really benefit from being in nature. And if you're reluctant in any way to bring your child outdoors hiking in the wintertime, there's a great book by a local author, and I think she's been on this program, Jennifer Aist. It's called Babes in the Woods, Hiking, Camping, and Backpacking with Your Babies and Young Children.
She has indeed been on this program, and you can find a program that features her through our Kids These Days archive, and you can just go to our website at kidsthesedays.org. You, of course, are listening to Kids These Days on this listener-supported station, and today we're talking about pretending, playing, and imagining, and how these things help our kids grow and grow up. I'm speaking with Robert Capuzzo of UAA and Shona Strausser, who's with Perseverance Theater. And we want to know what you remember pretending when you were a kid. You can write to us at mail at kidsthesedays.org. kidsthesedays.org and let us know now or comment on our Facebook page or website. So did you transform your bunk bed from a piece of furniture into a double-decker bus or a pirate ship or an apartment building occupied by stuffed animal tenants? Well, Kids These Days wanted to know what grown-ups remember pretending to do when they were little. So we jumped in our way back machine for another installment of our feature, When I Was Young. Sarah Gonzalez shares the memories.
When you were a child, what was your favorite thing to pretend?
Our favorite thing was to pretend with my best friend, Nancy Janelle, and we had a fort across the street from her house. And we had all sorts of different levels on that, and we kind of pretended we were Swiss Family Robinson. We'd pretend that we had ostriches that we were riding and that the pirates were coming, and then we'd have to go up to the different levels of the treehouse. That was one of the most fun things.
I really like to play as an imaginary chef when I was younger. Outside, I had this specific area where I'd hang out in the wooded area near my house. And I guess I used to just kind of act like I was running a restaurant with my parents' supervision. But I guess that was when I was very much a younger toddler. And as I grew up, of course, I went through different fantasies of being some sort of medieval hero, with the wooded areas around my house kind of playing setting as the whatever realm I imagined myself in. So.
I wanted to make believe that I was Elizabeth Taylor and horseback riding and national velvet. That was my dream. And I had the big dream that someday I would go to England, I would ride and be a steeplechaser. Unfortunately, I didn't get to do that, but I still horseback ride, but I don't do steeplechase.
I played with a friend at this creek in the Santa Monica Creek area. It was very secluded and beautiful, and we would take our ice cream sticks and make mermaids with the moss that grew in the water. We'd find little houses in the nooks and crannies in the creek and pretend that the mermaids were swimming there. It was really fun.
When you were a child, what was your favorite thing to pretend?
I liked to pretend that I was a space pirate or a space captain.
What's the difference between a space pirate and a space captain?
Well, one's good and one's evil, so it just depends on your mood and how you're feeling at the time. If there are any people in distress, you'd be, you know, space captain, felt like causing some trouble, you'd be a space pirate. Well, we didn't have a lot of props. We had laser pistols, which kind of started the whole thing, me and my brother. So that's kind of how it began. So everything else was imagination.
We played in the woods all the time. We ran through the woods and played cowboys and Indians with our little wooden sticks as guns. And it was me and my brother and my cousins.
Well, me and my neighborhood used to live in, I used to live in Portland in the inner city neighborhoods. And we used to play a game called Car Killer Shooter, where you pretend that there's a drive-by and you can just be playing a regular game and somebody yells Car Killer Shooter and then everybody runs for the bushes. And that was the most fun we could ever think of.
My girlfriends and I had a cabin, and we would draw on the street, on the gravel, all these different houses, and we'd be really elaborate. We would have our furniture drawn in, and then we would just play house and pretend we lived in this great mansion.
We would put on shows for my parents, you know, like variety shows and show tunes. We did it all. Yeah, we sang, danced, told jokes, the whole thing. We pretended we were Carol Burnett. Yeah, serious, any of those variety shows from there. The 60s.
Our producer Sarah Gonzalez gathered voices from some of the hardworking staff and volunteers helping out at KSKA FM last week. And one note that Sarah mentioned to me is that many of the people she questioned said that they couldn't remember playing and pretending as children. And then they were reluctant to say that on the record. And I think this is a great time in the time we have left to transition into talking about adulthood creativity and play. Shona Strausser, does that, you just said, like maybe you have a little understanding about why people might be reluctant or say they can't remember.
Well, it's, I mean, at this point, you know, adults are, you know, we're supposed to make money and, you know, do the things that adults are supposed to do. And so as we get older, people forget to play. They don't even take time to play. And that, you know, the play also sometimes becomes work. if you know what I mean. That it just becomes one more thing to do, you know. But I think about all the, you know, all of my friends and I, and we go, you know, up the mountain and ski down. Well, that's adult play, you know. that's big time adult fun. But there's for those people who are not engaged in kind of creativity in their work, they just don't get a lot of time to pretend. You know, it's not a time to pretend because it's practical time. I teach at UAS. I teach acting and theater at UAS, University of Alaska Southeast, and it's it takes a long time to get students who are not used to playing into the play world. It takes a long time, and they're just I guess it's years of sitting down in desks. It's they're putting their serious face on because they're in college now, and yeah, and so it's easy to forget that at one time we were all pretending to be pirates or
space captains, right?
Exactly.
So it seems to me like there might—I'm just guessing—but it seems to me it might almost be like a physical transformation that might have to happen to a person to transition from this, like, I am this adult professional person, I am in your class, to I'm going to let it all go and just let myself play. Is that true?
Yeah, well, adults, I mean, I used to think that middle schoolers were kind of the worst in the judgment realm. Like, they'd look at somebody and judge them, and, you know, I'm just kind of talking generally speaking. But adults are really in that realm, too, that, you know, they're definitely worried about what other people are thinking in the room about them, or, you know, what they look like, especially. And that's something that we just have to kind of fight through so that they can play, because you have to trust the other people in the room to play. You know, you just have to, because once you go into that realm of creativity, you just don't know what you're going to come up with. And it might, you know, it might be offensive to somebody, but in a realm of play, it's got to be okay.
Mm-hmm. Robert Capuzzo.
Yes, I see this semester after semester in the creativity class that I teach. Because part of it, as you mentioned, is really finding that inner child and that creativity you felt as a young child. These are all going to be teachers, and it's really important that teachers have this ability to be creative and have an imagination. Because in your classroom of 20-some children, you're going to need to be creative to help reach all of those learners. So in the class, it's funny because the first class period, it's very quiet. There's hardly any talking, and we'll play a game. And then as the class goes on, each week we do some sort of creative activity, either painting or doing an open-ended creation or making Play-Doh or using clay. And as the semester goes on, I just see these students opening up and saying that they love it, that they actually get to play, and that it's in a college classroom, which is very, very different from most of their other classes at UAA. And in one way, you'd think, well, should there be playing in a college classroom? And I think it's okay. We have to resolve this conflict that play isn't learning. Play can be learning. I think all of us could think that if you're doing something and you're enjoying it and you're playing with it, you're going to like doing it so much more. And I think the impetus is on the teacher or the professor or instructor to try to make that learning as enjoyable as possible.
Well, I can't thank each of you enough for the time that you spent with us this hour on Kids These Days. Shona Strasser is the Education Director for Perseverance Theater in Juneau. She joined us today from her travels in Los Angeles. And Robert Capuzzo is an Associate Professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage, specializing in early childhood development. Thanks, both of you, for being with us. It's really been fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a while since we heard from her, but back today is our one and only Dr. KTD. Michelle Laufer is an Anchorage pediatrician who offers her advice to Kids These Days listeners in our regular Dr. KTD feature. Today, Dr. Laufer shares her medical opinion on imaginary friends.
Preschoolers are some of the most imaginative
people in the world. And one of the ways they develop social and conversational skills is through their imaginative play, which if you've ever watched a preschooler is really fascinating to watch. So as part of this, some kids develop imaginary friends, which can be human friends, animal friends, just characters with whom they work through these conversational and social dilemmas. And they show up, you know, in the preschool years, and generally by the time kids go to school, they've resolved. Imaginary friends are not only nothing to worry about, but they're very healthy. Yeah, they're really a sign of preschoolers' ability to go between real life and fantasy life and act things out and play things out. And some people think that kids who have imaginary friends end up being the more creative people in the world. So really nothing to worry about. We do have people who ask, you know, I'm concerned my child is speaking to things that aren't there, and nothing to worry about, and in fact, really a good thing. So children really do go back and forth between reality and fantasy, preschool children, and they will often say their friend, their doll, did something sort of as a way to try things out. How might this be responded to in the real world? And so if you can get into that fantasy world with the child and respond, oh, well, you know, I see Sally, your doll or your imaginary friend made a poor choice. How do you think we should handle that? Help the child work that through in the fantasy world. And then you may notice some of those things happening in the real world. As well, you can use the fantasy world to prepare your child for things. Going to the doctor or starting school, you know, talking about how does so-and-so, your doll or your imaginary friend, feel about starting school? How would they feel about their first day of kindergarten or their first day of preschool or visiting the dentist? And you might get some insight into what your child's thinking. I very often do physical exams on dolls and stuffed animals with the child before I examine them, and it really seems to help the process. Eight or a 10-year-old playing with an imaginary friend would be less typical. And at that point, I might try and delve in a little bit more in terms of what makes you think they have an imaginary friend. What is that? What is the child actually talking about? Are they playing things out? Are they making things up? At that point, you'd probably want to talk to someone if you still had that worry.
Michelle Laffer is a board-certified pediatrician. You can find out more about her and listen to past Dr. KTD pieces by going to kidsthesedays.org and searching for Dr. KTD. Good news for creative young procrastinators. The Kids These Days / 49 Writers Write Young Alaska Essay Contest has been extended for one more week. There's still time for you to tell us what it means to you to be a kid these days in 500 words or less. In addition to having your work featured on our air, winners will also receive a cool KTD canvas tote bag. Turn in entries by Friday, October 28th at wyakcontests.com. That's all one word. Or get there through kidsthesedays.org. That's all for the show this week, but remember, the conversation doesn't end here. You can keep it going online. Find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or frequent kidsthesedays.org. We feature a handful of fascinating bloggers who write just for us. Take your pick of perspectives, from high school students to outdoor families, to down-home cooking to a Southeast dad. Find all those voices and more right there. That's kidsthesedays.org. Special thanks to Michelle Laufer, our Dr. KTD. Both Jessica Cochran and Sarah Gonzalez reported from Anchorage today. Jessica is our regular contributor, assistant producer, and technical editor. Sarah is our producer, web content manager, and all other details person. Loss Lander composed and performed our theme music. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Thanks for spending time with me today, and we'll see you next time.
The ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the hosts, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The Content Producers Guild is solely responsible for what you hear on the program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.